Our reading this evening is from John's Gospel, chapter 9, and you'll find that on page 1079. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned, or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he's like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him, since he's opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight, until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age, he will speak for himself." His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." He answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" And they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." The man answered, "Why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshipper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and would you teach us?" And they cast him out. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains."
Thank you very much, Jeremy, for that very long reading. Do keep Bibles open. These sheets will also be a help to you as we look at that together. I don't know if you came across the headline a couple of years ago. If you were reading the Times, you will have noticed the headline right across the top, which said, "God did not create the universe." Bit of a shock, you know, you wake up one morning and discover that as you read your newspaper. It was a report about the greatest British scientist, Stephen Hawking, that he declared that there is no place for God in the creation of the universe as he understands it. And that's why it got reported. But it's not just experts in physics who reject the teaching of the Bible and deny God's existence. We find the same verdict from such great intellects as Marie Curie, Sigmund Freud, Bertrand Russell. In fact, I even found out recently that no less a man than Daniel Radcliffe of Harry Potter fame has also declared that in his opinion there is no God. So with such a glittering display of experts lined up to discredit the Christian faith, how is it that we can possibly take it seriously? Now, surely if the Bible were really true, you might argue that there should be a consensus amongst intelligent people. And as the title to today's talk puts it, surely so many experts can't be wrong. Now, I think this is a big issue for us in the 21st century, isn't it? But I think it was an even greater issue if we were believers in the first century. Now, in the last chapter, I know we've had a break for quite a while since we looked at chapter 8, so I'll recap. But in that chapter, Jesus was confronted by the religious experts of his day. And these people had heard Jesus' claims, they'd seen his miracles, and their verdict on him was that he was possessed by a demon. And they actually were ready to pick up stones, and they were about to stone him, execute him for blasphemy, because he was claiming to be God. And we were left at the end of that chapter asking the question, why did so many intelligent, expert people, people who actually saw Jesus' miracles, end up not believing in him? Surely so many experts can't be wrong. Now, behind this kind of objection is that at the very least, there is a communication problem. You see, if God is real, but so many intelligent people believe otherwise, then we must at least ask ourselves, and this is our whole series title on the top of the sheets, why doesn't God make himself clearer? But what we're going to see in this passage, as we examine this whole issue of widespread unbelief, is that there is a communication problem. It is true. But we're going to see that the problem is not at God's end, but at ours. So let's look at these verses together. And I've put the first heading there, Jesus' light shines for all to see. So in this first verse of the passage, we're introduced to a man, a beggar, who is going to dominate this chapter. Verse 1, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. I think it's hard for us to imagine what this experience would be like. This is a guy who's never known what a smile looks like. He's never seen colour. He's lived his whole life in total darkness. And we're going to examine in this chapter his encounter with the Lord Jesus. And the first thing this guy experiences about Jesus, I've put there on the sheets, is Jesus' liberating teaching. Verse 2, and Jesus' disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now, I doubt that this was the first time people had discussed this man's disability like this, you know, as though he's just an interesting theological conundrum. And I guess it would have been deeply humiliating for him to have these kinds of conversations around him, people assuming that he wasn't just pitiful, but also that at some level he deserved it. I don't know, maybe he had actually come to believe this himself, that he was to blame in some way for his disability. Or perhaps he attributed his suffering to others, like his parents, which I guess would have led to this a kind of festering anger and bitterness in him. But here, probably for the first time in his life, he hears a completely different perspective on his suffering. Verse 3. It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. And you can imagine just how wonderful, how liberating this would have been to hear for this guy. This man is learning that even though God is not to blame for his suffering, so the Bible teaches that suffering entered this world due to humanity's rebellion against God. But Jesus is saying here that ultimately God will use the man's suffering for good. It's not meaningless. Now, in this particular instance, God is going to bring glory to himself through healing this man. But elsewhere in the Bible, with the Apostle Paul, God brings glory to himself not by healing and taking away the thorn, but by giving Paul grace to endure that suffering. So whether God heals or not in a particular situation, God uses his people's suffering for his good purposes and to reveal his glory. And so here we see, for the first time in his life, this man discovering that there is hope. There is a purpose, even in his desperate situation. And he realizes that this is a teacher who is not like anyone else he's ever come across. And the next thing this guy experiences, I've put there, is Jesus' outrageous claims. Jesus continues in verse 4, "We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work." So here, just in this phrase, we see Jesus is claiming to have been sent by God to do God's work on earth. But there's even more. Verse 5, Jesus says, "As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." Now, for most of us, this will be kind of familiar teaching, Jesus, light of the world. But it's really shocking and scandalous. Jesus is claiming here the world is a very dark place. It's ignorant, it's wicked, but that he is the one source of revelation and truth and goodness for every human being, for every culture. Now, can you imagine if you or I were to just drop that into conversation? It's an extraordinary thing to say. But Jesus doesn't just make these staggering claims. He backs them up with demonstrations of his divine power. Because next, verse 6, "Having said these things, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, 'Go, wash in the pool of Siloam,' which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing." This is amazing. Technically, Jesus does not restore this man's sight because there's never been any sight to restore. Jesus has to start from scratch and create sight out of nothing. So just as at creation, where God creates the first human being out of the dust of the earth, out of mud, so here Jesus gets some mud and he creates working eyes for the man. You see, this is a miracle that no one in history, as far as I'm aware, has even claimed to be able to do, creating sight in a person who has been born blind. And once again, in this chapter, we see that although they do their best, not even Jesus' enemies can deny the reality that this miracle did happen. So even in the midst of all kinds of opposition to Jesus, Jesus' light shines for all to see. His liberating teaching, his outrageous claims, his divine power. At one level, his light is undeniable, unavoidable. As someone has written, "The light of Christ is not an inference from premises. It is the brightness of God shining on the retina of the human soul. You know it's there, not because you conclude it from an argument, but because you see it with the eyes of your heart. So last week, our car's backlight broke, and I pulled into a garage, and a guy kindly replaced it for us. But after he'd done it, I didn't demand to the man that he proved to me that what was coming out of that bulb really was light. You see, the whole point about light is it proves itself. It doesn't need any further confirmation. That's why we use the phrase, it's clear as day. It's just obvious. And when so many people around us don't believe, it's very easy, isn't it, to buy into this lie that the communication problem must be at God's end of things. We think that he's not communicating, revealing himself. And then my tendency is either to pipe down and stay quiet about Jesus, or instead of pointing to Jesus, I subtly shift to pointing to something which I think will be a bit more impressive, whether it's pointing to prominent people who believe, or to a dramatic change in an individual's life, or to clever arguments which support the Christian worldview. Instead of trusting that Jesus really is the light of the world, he is the one who reveals God. There's nothing deficient in Jesus' revelation of God, his authority, his teaching, his fulfillment of prophecy, perhaps most remarkably of all, his character. They all shine out from him. So let's not be discouraged, and let's keep believing this. Let's keep pointing people to the light of the world. But although Jesus' light is perfectly clear, most of this chapter is about a contrast between two different responses to the light, which, as we'll see, end up with two very different outcomes. So let's look at point two together. As we respond to Jesus, he gives us increasing sight. Now, this chapter is actually a contrast with Jesus' healing back in chapter 5. So both of these healings, they occur on a Sabbath. Both of them, just Jesus, after healing the person, he goes and finds them on their own afterwards. But in chapter 5, the man gets healed, and that's it. He seems to take no interest in the person who's healed him. Whereas in this chapter, the man's eyes are not simply opened physically, which is just covered in a couple of verses, but most of this chapter is devoted to the even greater miracle of Jesus opening his eyes spiritually. And it happens as he responds to the light that he has been shown. So, as we've already seen, first of all, this man, he hears something of Jesus' teaching and his claims. And then when Jesus commands him, in verse 7, he says, go, wash in the pool of Siloam. He obeys Jesus. He responds. And it's as he responds and obeys that he receives physical sight. But receiving spiritual sight happens much more gradually for him. So we see in this passage this gradual growth in understanding. So he starts at the beginning. He just refers Jesus to Jesus as this man called Jesus in verse 11. Then by verse 17, he's calling him a prophet. And by the time we get to verse 38, he's finally bowing down and worshipping Jesus. So there's this gradual growth. And it all happens as he responds to the light that he has been shown. And he does this even in the context I put there of fierce and illogical opposition. In fact, we learn in verse 22 that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, that is God's promised king, he was to be put out of the synagogue. So this is a very serious threat. Here is a beggar, a man who depends entirely on other people just to live, just to eat. And he's being threatened here by the authorities with total social exclusion, being frozen out from society. Not to mention the spiritual cost of being cut off from the people of God if he sides with Jesus. And in verse 24, there's the most biased court case imaginable. They say to him, "Give glory to God," verse 24. "We know that this man is a sinner." So the verdict in this case is declared before the evidence is even heard. It's absurd. But instead of bowing to the pressures all around him, which actually is what the man in chapter 5 did, who actually went and reported Jesus to the authorities, this man in chapter 9, he realized there is something far more important at stake here, even than social exclusion. And although he doesn't know much, he sincerely and he honestly responds to the light that he has received. So verse 25, he answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." And as he honestly stands for the truth, we see him here, he grows in clarity and in confidence. Verse 27, he answered them, "I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" So do you see there, he's declaring himself publicly to be a disciple of Jesus, despite the enormous cost. Verse 28, and they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we don't know where he comes from." That's interesting there in verse 29, how illogical, how unpersuasive this opposition against Jesus is. So do you see, instead of grappling with the miracle and what it implies about who Jesus is, they're simply dismissing Jesus. And the reason they give is because they don't know where Jesus is from. It's just illogical. It reminds me actually of some of the logic that the false atheists are using, sorry, that the new atheists are trying to use at the moment. So in trying to argue that God doesn't exist, I don't know if you've read much new atheist literature, but they spend a lot of time trying to prove that God is nasty. The most unpleasant character in all fiction is how Dawkins describes God. But you see, that is bizarre logic. How you and I feel about God and his character logically has no bearing whatsoever on whether he does or doesn't exist. But what these kinds of attacks on God do achieve is they reveal the intense hatred against God which motivates these people. And that is what explains then the prejudiced way in which they then approach the evidence. I've got a friend who many of you will know because he used to come to this church, Paul Whiting. And I actually knew him just as he was becoming a Christian back at university. And just as he was weighing it all up, he decided to read an essay by the atheist Bertrand Russell called "Why I Am Not a Christian." And as you can imagine, his friends who are Christian, like me, we were all a little bit worried about this. But actually, as Paul read this essay, the illogical hostility in it against God actually confirms all that Paul had been learning from the Bible, that human beings are not neutral and that we do need Jesus' rescue. And ironically, a little bit like this man in the passage, this was just the persuasion that Paul needed to push him over the edge, because the next day he gave his life to Jesus. So as this man in the passage, as he responds to the light that he's received, in spite of the opposition, his understanding and his conviction grows. And in verse 30, this beggar, who I take it, I imagine he's never been to school, he's never learnt to read, but he boldly points out to the intellectual and religious experts of his day their irrational thinking. Verse 30, the man answered, "Why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshipper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Now, this is actually very powerful logic. But sadly, the experts are not interested. Verse 34, they answered him, "You were born in utter sin," just as the disciples' question assumed in verse 2, "and would you teach us?" And they cast him out. This is horrific. I guess this man has clearly, he's lived a dreadful life. But I guess he never felt more alone than at this moment, being cast out. And then Jesus, who is full of compassion and who honours sincere seekers for truth, he goes after him and he finds him. Verse 35, Jesus heard that they had cast him out. And having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. So do you see, all doubt is now gone. Jesus has opened this man's eyes spiritually to Jesus' true identity, and he will never be the same again. As we respond to Jesus graciously, he gives us increasing sight and clarity. This week I was talking to two people who are both seeking the truth, but they both feel that it's all a bit too difficult. One of them said to me this week, "I've heard the evidence for the resurrection, but it all happened so long ago, we could never really know for sure, could we?" I don't know how you would respond to that if someone said that to you. But actually, I'd just spent the morning looking at this passage, and John 9 was in my brain. So I was able to say to them, "Well, look, spiritual certainty is possible. God really does reveal himself to people. Jesus says back in chapter 7, if anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority." And so I encourage them, a bit like the guy in this passage, to respond to the light that they had already received from Jesus, to take an opportunity to stand for Jesus publicly, to start listening to Jesus and his teaching, and to start putting it into practice. And that is how they will receive spiritual certainty and assurance. I know that's certainly been my own experience, and I guess many would echo that in this room. For some of us, we may be believers, but if we're honest, we'd say that we feel pretty numb spiritually. Perhaps for you, it all just feels a little bit like just words, just routine. Somewhere along the line, it's stopped feeling real for you. And if that is the case, it's worth asking ourselves, are we responding to the light that we have been shown? Or perhaps there is something we need to deal with in our lives, like a bitterness or a wrong relationship or an unwillingness to be known as a Christian. In fact, for all of us, wherever we stand with respect to Jesus, the call of this passage is to respond to him, to trust him, to do what he says, especially to take opportunities to speak up for him. And that is how we will grow in clarity and in faith. As Paul says to Philemon, and I put the reference there on the sheets, it's as we share our faith that our understanding of every good thing we have in Christ will deepen. That is how it works. But actually, as we close, this passage warns us that this principle also works in reverse. And that this is point three. But if we refuse Jesus and don't respond to his light, we become blind. Now, just as we've seen, this beggar, he grows gradually in his understanding of the truth as we look through this passage. All the time, the religious authorities are moving in precisely the opposite direction. So they start off with verse 16, this man is not from God. But by verse 24, they're declaring, this man, Jesus, is a sinner, which is a much more dangerous place to be spiritually. These people are so determined not to believe in Jesus that they just refuse the clear evidence right in front of their eyes. Now, for some of us, we might think this is bizarre. I mean, surely people are more rational than that, aren't they? I mean, don't human beings pursue truth wherever it leads them? Well, sadly not. The renowned atheist writer Aldous Huxley described his own experience this way. He said, I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning, and consequently, I assumed that it had none and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. Actually, this is a fascinating admission from him. He is confessing that he decided not to believe in God because he didn't want God to exist. Because God's existence would conflict with the lifestyle that he wanted to live. So he actually goes on and he says, for myself, as no doubt for most of my friends, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. So as Huxley admits, we human beings are far less rational than we like to think we are. Now, for the Pharisees in this passage, it's not their sexual freedom that Jesus is threatening. It is their power base. If Jesus is who he claims, then they are no longer the top religious authorities. And I think that seems to be the reason why they're so determined to reject him. But the effect of this is that they leave the encounter with Jesus here in far worse shape spiritually than when they started. Jesus says in verse 39, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see. I.e., Jesus is saying here that he came that people like this beggar will see who he is. And, Jesus continues, so that those who see may become blind. And Jesus is talking here about the hardening that comes on those who at one level can see Jesus' light, i.e. they've heard or seen something about Jesus, and yet who refuse to respond to that light. And Jesus says that they end up being blinded spiritually, unable to respond. Now, this teaching is very sobering because it warns each of us that if we refuse to respond to the light that we have been shown, part of God's judgment on us is that we will become hardened. We will become less able to see the truth. And that is a dreadful situation to fall into. Now, of course, this is highly relevant for us if we're looking into the faith. But it's also a warning for us as believers. So I know believers who have gone through serious crises of faith. But very often, when you just probe a little bit, it's clear that their spiritual confusion very often follows pretty swiftly from a decision at some stage to ignore Jesus' teaching in some area of their life. And from that moment on, they start to spiral downwards into all kinds of doubts and confusion. If we refuse Jesus' light, it will become harder and harder to see it. But overall, I think this passage for most of us is actually a huge encouragement. I guess for most of us, we do feel intimidated, discouraged, don't we, by this glittering display of experts all lined up to try and discredit our faith. And I guess most of us will know of intelligent people whom we respect who have looked into the Christian faith and then have rejected it. And so I guess all of us are tempted to think, well, perhaps Jesus' light isn't as clear, it isn't as impressive as I once thought it was. And if that is the case, this chapter is a huge reassurance to us that the so-called experts are not as rational as they like to think. In fact, for us who, by God's grace, have been given spiritual sight, we needn't be intimidated by the loud opinions of those who cannot yet see. But rather we need to engage them, we need to pray for them, and we need to point them to the world's glorious light, the Lord Jesus. Now, thankfully, for most of us here, unlike many of our brothers and sisters, Christian brothers and sisters around the world, many of us here won't have experienced persecution because we follow Christ. But I guess we're all aware of the subtle pressure from parts of our society which seek to discredit our faith. I guess many here will have discovered that being loyal to Jesus in our day will often mean being labelled as narrow or judgmental or bigoted. Some in this congregation I know live day by day just feeling like an outsider at work or in their social group. Others I know in this congregation have faced family disapproval. Some have been written out of wills. Others in this congregation have literally been estranged from their families because of your loyalty to Jesus. And the experience of the man in this passage is a wonderful encouragement for us, because it reminds us that stemming right back to Jesus' own day, opposition has always been the context for following Jesus. And so if this is our experience at the moment, which it will be for many, we are in very good company. And we can actually be encouraged that we're on track and that we can keep going. And we're actually going to sing in a moment, and a song about Jesus being the light of the world and our response to worship him. It's a song which could even nearly have been written by the man in this passage. But first, we're going to take a moment's quiet to reflect on the truths we've been looking at and to respond personally before our Creator. And then as the music starts, we'll stand and sing together.